You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. Now, whether you're stocking your first kitchen or adding to your growing collection, it's sometimes hard to know which kitchen items are right for your personal cooking needs. We talk to the authors of The Ultimate Guide to Kitchen Gadgets, from wooden spoons to espresso machines and everything in between. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your must-have tools, appliances, and gadgets in the kitchen? Do you have a brand that you always trust to do the job? What's your favorite kitchen item to give as a housewarming or wedding gift? And what questions do you have for our kitchen gearheads? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lisa McManus and Hannah Crawley are executive editors for America's Test Kitchen and co-hosts of ATK's Gearheads on YouTube. They're co-authors of the new book, Kitchen Gear, The Ultimate Owner's Manual. Hannah, welcome to Central Time, and Lisa, welcome back.
Thank you for having us.
So Lisa, yes. Yeah, glad to have you. Lisa, whether we're moving into a new place, our first place, or downsizing, sometimes it's hard to know what we need in our kitchen and what we can safely leave out. So my question is, what are the absolute musts, the absolute kitchen essentials that we have to have to cover most of the bases?
Well, we really think about it in terms of having a few pieces that will do different multiple things for you. So I would say start with a good 12-inch skillet, because you can always cook less food in a big skillet, but not the other way around. We love cast iron. That's a good all-purpose skillet. We love a Dutch oven, which is a big pot. At least 6 quarts, 7 is fine too. That gives you a lot of flexibility in cooking soups and stews or doing anything really big. We bake bread in that. We deep fry in that. So the pieces that you choose really give you some flexibility. You want a really good chef's knife that's nice and sharp, a good cutting board, gives you plenty of space to chop things. And really that's, you know, with those couple of pieces, you can really start and build from there.
Hannah, what do you think about single-use gadgets like apple corers or potato mashers, things that are just for one thing? Do you think they're worth the space, or could we accomplish the task without them?
I think if they're worth it for you, they're worth the space. Like your examples, for example, Lisa has an apple core that she loves and uses every year, and it brings her absolute delight in the fall. So I think that's worth it. And also, like potato mashers, for example, we do different things with potato mashers. So I think that sometimes you can think creatively, and they're not actually a one-hit wonder. And part of our book is talking about getting more use out of quote unquote single use gadgets and seeing what else they can do for you, so you don't end up with a lot of clutter you're not using and you use the tools you have.
Hannah, give me a couple of examples. Like, what can you do with a potato masher besides just smash potatoes?
They're actually great for making guacamole. Believe it or not, they can mash perfectly, but not too finely. Especially if you have one arm, which I did when my arm was in a sling and found this out.
You found out the hard way then.
I did. It was worth it though.
Lisa, I'm going to ask you, what are there things that are really just a gimmick? Things that you can safely say, no, forget it. You just don't need that.
Oh boy. Of course, I can't think of a thing right in this moment. you don't really need chopping devices. If you have a good knife and you keep it sharp and you have a cutting board, you don't need all kinds of specialized choppers. There's so many things on the market just to design to not have you use the knife you already have.
Hannah, what are some new or trendy kitchen items? Any new essentials that you've tried that you really like?
New essentials. Well, I think we are all so into these indoor pizza ovens that can get like professional pizza oven temperatures, like the Breville Pizzaiolo and a new model from Uni. And they're just so fun. And the pizza they make is incredible. And it's just like a reason for a party too. I love that. Like, I'm like, come over, I'm making pizza. And you can really personalize all the pizzas. On the other hand, they are $1,000. Lisa and I are going to do an upcoming, I know, right? An upcoming episode on Gearheads of these two. There's really two top models in the game right now, one from Breville and one from Uni. So we're going to battle it out in an upcoming episode of Gearheads called the Ultimate Battle of the $1,000 Pizza Ovens.
Do you feel like those prices will come down eventually when more manufacturers come out with them?
I sure hope so, but I do think they're also pretty pricey to get something that can sit indoors on your countertop and get up to, you know, 8, 9, 1,000 degrees.
Yeah. I mean, they're pretty cool though. I mean, I've seen some videos and oh boy, it's on my want list, but man, it's so steep. Lisa McManus and Hannah Crawley are executive editors for America's Test Kitchen. They are co-hosts of ATK's Gearheads on YouTube, co-authors of the new book, Kitchen Gear, The Ultimate Owner's Manual. Is there a kitchen gadget that transformed your cooking regime? Call in 800-642-1234. So Lisa, if we're going to shell out big bucks for an appliance or item, pizza aside, are there items where cost really does equal quality?
Very, very often we can find things that have some of the qualities of the top priced items that are more affordable. But occasionally you do need to spend a little more. We've tested a lot of food processors, for instance, and, you know, our favorite is around $200. You can get a cheaper one, but they really don't perform on the same level. Blenders, we have a mid-price blender in the $200 range. When you get around 100 and less, they're just, you know, big counter decorations. They don't do anything. Yeah. They get stuck right away. So sometimes you got to pay a little more, especially if you're doing a lot of asking a lot of that appliance.
Yeah. Hannah, what about the opposite? Where are there some high-end versions that are really just the same as cheap ones? I mean, where you could save money by, you know, just opting for the less expensive version. Is there a certain appliance that comes to mind?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind isn't an appliance necessarily, but like a good kitchen knife. For example, our winner from Victorinox is about $40, and you can find gorgeous knives that, you know, get into several hundreds of dollars, and trust me, they're fantastic, and I want one too, but this $40 knife from Victorinox does a heck of a good job, and so I don't think you have to spend a ton to get great performance on a knife.
Sure. Hannah, we have some Facebook comments that came in. Jacqueline said that her hand crank pasta maker was a waste of money. Do you think those hand crank pasta makers are worth it?
It's funny. I have one. I love it. I haven't used it in 2 years, so I feel her pain. I think it's like, oh, they sure are fun. If you use it, it's worth it. Again, like if you use it, it's worth it. Me, I still want mine now that I have it. Someday I'll have a pasta party, but like, no, I'm in the same boat. I'm not using that every weekend by any means.
Yeah, exactly. I know I have one too, and I've only used it once, but I loved it when I used it. So
exactly.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, for gearheads like you two, is probably unrealistic to stick to just the basics. How do you manage space in your kitchen to store it all? I mean, this is something that I struggle with, trying to find where to put everything.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we do have some tips for how to store things. One thing I'll say is if you want to use a cast iron pan more, don't put it on a low or high shelf. Keep it on the same level as your stovetop, and you will be able to grab it and move it there more easily and use it more often. We have ways to organize your spices, your utensils, and a lot of it just comes down to keep the things close to you that you use really often. And things like that pasta roller that you're only going to use a couple times a year, don't have it in a primo spot that you have to reach past to get the things you use every day. So really think about the core of what you're using and build out from there.
And Lisa, I also want to ask you about cast iron. Why is cast iron so popular still? I mean, it's something that has been around forever. What makes it so superior in your opinion?
I think two things. One is the reason it's been around forever is that those pans are durable. You know, short of like, I don't know, running it over with a tank, they won't break. There's nothing going to happen to them. So many things that we buy in this world wear out, and a cast iron pan won't if you treat it with just any kind of routine care that just keeps it in good shape. But even if it gets rusty, you can scrub it, oil it, heat it, and go back to using it. The other is that it's real thick material that is super heat retaining. So if you want some beautiful browning, whether you're searing something or you're baking something in it, like cornbread, or if you're searing a steak, you can get fantastic color on your food because it will retain that heat and then radiate it back. And it's a beautiful pan, and it will last forever, and it's not expensive.
Right. Sometimes you can find them, you know, at a thrift shop or a flea market for next to nothing. But I guess my question is, what's the best way to take care of it? Hannah, how do you keep those cast iron pans clean? You know, this isn't something you can throw in the dishwasher.
Yeah, definitely don't do that. You know, I've learned a lot from Lisa over the years. She really is our cast iron expert. And I think my favorite thing I've learned from her is that you don't need to use a ton of oil. You know, so with a cast iron pan, after you use it, you want to wash it. You know, just a scrub brush and water is usually sufficient. You can use a little soap if you need to. And then you put it on the burner to warm up and dry off, and just like a teaspoon of oil, and rub it all around, and then leave it on the stovetop to dry. And I've learned that from Lisa, and it really works. And my cast iron pan is probably definitely my most used skillet.
Lisa, what other things can't be thrown in the dishwasher besides cast iron pans?
This is my endless stump speech. It's like, don't put things in the dishwasher that don't have to go in there. Because the dishwasher is a very harsh environment. So never put bladed tools. Your knives should not go in there. Your vegetable peeler, anything that you want to keep sharp, don't put in there. Because the long time that it stays hot and wet and this strong soap is going to just degrade the edge. You also don't want to put anything that's wooden in there. Wood is a natural material. It will soak up that water, and then as it dries, it cracks. So you're going to shorten the lifespan of anything wooden. Cookware doesn't really need to go in the dishwasher either. And if you, you know, put it in there, we found some pans really get very degraded by it. A straight aluminum baking sheet will turn darkened. The edges of a stainless steel pan may erode a little bit and become sharp.
Oh, I do.
You know,
that.
You just really want to pay attention to what you're putting in there. Use your glassware, your dishes, your silverware in there. But a lot of the cooking utensils, set yourself up to comfortably and quickly wash them by hand.
Yeah. And I'm going to admit right now, I do that. I am lazy. I do that. So, but I'm not going to do it anymore. We're with Lisa McManus and Hannah Crowley, executive editors for America's Test Kitchen and co-hosts of ATK's Gearheads on YouTube, talking with them about their new book, Kitchen Gear, The Ultimate Owner's Manual. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is there a big ticket kitchen item that you think is worth the price tag? How about an item you regret buying? Is there a seemingly silly gadget you have in your kitchen that's actually quite useful? What's your desert island kitchen item? The one thing that you just, desert island kitchen item, the one thing you just couldn't live without. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post it on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up this conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Lisa McManus and Hannah Crowley, executive editors for America's Test Kitchen. They're co-hosts of ATK's Gearheads on YouTube and authors of the new book, Kitchen Gear, The Ultimate Owner's Manual. We're talking to them about how to select, use, and maintain your kitchen equipment. You can call in at 800-642-1234 if you have an item in your kitchen that has held up throughout the years or even decades, or have a question you'd like to ask. 800-642-1234. Hannah, usually when we're in the kitchen, we're dealing with heat, right? I mean, I'm wondering, which materials should we be mindful of not getting too hot, whether it's in the oven or on the stove or microwave? And which materials can withstand the highest heat?
Great question. We do a lot of thinking about this. And especially right now, I'm sure that folks have heard, you know, just in the zeitgeist, concerns about plastic. So we are very cognizant of when a product has plastic on it or in it, and nonstick, like what is layered on your skillet and in many, many things in your household, inside your ketchup bottle, on all sorts of utensils, all over the kitchen. That's a thin layer of plastic to prevent things from sticking. And you don't want to get that too hot because it can off-gas. And it off-gases at around 500 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's when there are fumes coming off of the pan that are not good for you to ingest. So you want to be really careful of anything that has plastic. And on the opposite side, you can take carbon steel and cast iron, you know, take those as hot as you want, put them on the grill, put them on the stove. You can't put them in the microwave, but mm-hmm. other than that, they are really versatile and super, super durable.
Let's go to Megan from Appleton. Megan is with us now. Hi, Megan. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm looking to get my mother an immersion blender. She's got pretty bad arthritis, and so I'm looking for something that's ergonomical and will be great for when she's canning applesauce or pureeing soups.
Oh, okay. Well, Hannah, do you have any recommendations for Megan?
Yeah, we love the Braun. Actually, we do quite a bit of testing looking at diminished options for folks with diminished hand strength as well, because that comes up for sure. So I would check out the Braun. I would also, you know, see how where the trigger button is to turn the product on, you know, make sure that's in a comfortable spot where she's got some strength going for her. And, you know, definitely check out our review and I can send you over something separately for her of the best option there as well. And this is all in the book too. I think there are a lot of products that require certain angles or certain wrist or hand or arm strength. And we try to consider that too in testing. We'll have lefties and righties and folks of all different abilities because we're all so different. So we want to make sure we find tools that work for everybody.
Thanks for that. That's really interesting and a really, really good information. I'm glad Megan called with that. Let's talk with Dave now. Dave is calling from Madison. Hi, Dave. What's your question?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a glass top stove. I think they're becoming really common right now. And to my great annoyance, the first time I used cast iron on it, it scratched it. So I can't use cast iron. That's really sad. I do sometimes use my Le Creuset, you know, Dutch oven. I'm real careful with it. And then I also find with my older Revereware pots, they're not flat bottom, so they rock and roll and don't really heat very well. So I guess I'm looking for, you know, what do I do? What are my good substitutes, or am I missing something in the way I'm using cast iron? I'll take my comment off the air. Thanks.
All right, great. Lisa, how about you? What advice do you have for Dave on the cookware?
With more people getting glass top electric stoves in particular, the flatness of the pan is kind of important. You can use your cast iron, but again, you probably know this, that if you pull or drag or move it on the glass, you can scratch it. If you're doing things like using a heavy cast iron pot or pan, lift it gently, place it, don't slide it back and forth. Don't drag it across the surface. If you want to work with those that cookware that isn't quite flat, you can basically add a little more oil and give the pan more time to preheat. You're going to give it several minutes to let that heat spread through the pan so it's less dependent on full contact with each spot of the bottom on the surface. And that will help mitigate that uneven bottom of the pan on that very flat top. It's unfortunate that it's so common because it's not a really great, glass is a terrible conductor of heat. And I know it looks sleek, but it's not the greatest way to cook. have it now. Mm-hmm. And it's not a great stove design, I'll be honest. But the way to work around that is give your pans time to preheat fully. Maybe use a little more oil and let that will convey some of the heat through it and carry it out a little bit better than if you're trying to use just a little tiny patch of oil, because it will not transmit the heat as fully.
Okay. Well, thanks for the advice on that. Appreciate the call as well. John is with us now from Wanakee. Hi, John. You have a favorite gadget you want to recommend. What is it?
Well, hello, everybody. Thanks for taking my call. Have you guys ever heard of a Rotato?
A Rotato.
A Rotato.
I don't think I have.
Lisa, Hannah, no?
No, it doesn't sound familiar. What is it?
It's one of those gizmos that you see on TV, believe it or not. And I don't know, I picked it up at Bed Bath or Beyond or something like that a while back, started using it, and then they discontinued them. I went and bought two more because I liked it so much, just to get the blades for it. Essentially, you stick a potato on it, and you put the little arm on it that has a blade, and you crank it, and you turn it, and it does a beautiful job of peeling apples and potatoes and anything that you need to peel. It's super easy. I've actually taken a potato and peeled and peeled and peeled and peeled and peeled until it's a half an inch in diameter, and all those shavings make great hash browns. It's a really ridiculous little tool, but I love it. It's the greatest thing. And I have a Braun full immersion blender, and I love it.
All right. Great advice. Thanks, John. We'll have to try that. I appreciate it. We've got about a minute left, and I just want to ask, I mean, your book has this helpful gift buying guide. I'm just wondering if there's a can't go wrong gift you recommend for weddings or housewarmings. Lisa?
I love our favorite little salt cellar and a box of Malden's flaked salt. It's a wonderful little way to, especially for housewarming. It's a beautiful little square box with a cedar lid that stays open so you can reach in with one hand, and a box of beautiful flaked Malden salt, which is great on salads and all kinds of things. I think it's a nice little gift, and they're so pretty.
Briefly, Hannah, do you have a favorite, a can't-go-wrong gift you recommend?
Sure. Well, for a wedding, if you're going to splurge, of course, a Le Creuset Dutch oven is a fun choice. For like a housewarming or something like that, I love to gift a quarter or an eighth of a sheet pan. It's such a funny little gift, but you can tie like a cute bow on it and, you know, give it to them with a bottle of wine. And they will call you in a month and be like, I use this thing every single day.
Fantastic. I want to thank both of you, Lisa and Hannah, for joining us. This has been a great discussion.
Thank you so much for having us.
Lisa McManus and Hannah Crowley are executive editors for America's Test Kitchen. They're co-hosts of ATK's Gearheads on YouTube and co-authors of the new book Kitchen Gear, The Ultimate Owner's Manual. They talk to us about kitchen equipment, how to choose it, how to use it, and how to make it last. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, the new Wisconsin State Toxicologist at the State Laboratory of Hygiene joins to talk about the lab's public health and environmental focus, along with issues facing labs around the state. Also, the State Capitol Report happens on Monday as well on The Morning Show. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. Now, after being without a Speaker of the House since October 3rd, when Republican Kevin McCarthy of California was ousted from the position, Republicans united on Wednesday this week to elect Representative Mike Johnson of Louisiana to run things in the House. Johnson has been a vocal and unapologetic ally of former President Trump and was a proponent of overturning the results of the 2020 election, in particular, the votes in Michigan, Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. What more should we know about who Johnson is and how he ascended to this powerful position, just third in line behind the vice president to become the leader of the United States? And now that the 3 weeks of speakerless dust has started to settle, how is he going to be part of addressing the multiple crises facing the federal government at home and abroad? And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Johnson and his ascension? What thoughts do you have about how things played out this week in Congress, with multiple candidates emerging, then flaming out for various reasons, not the least of which was a still powerful thumbs up or thumbs down from former President Trump? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Maurice Shepherd is a professor of political science at Madison College. Maurice, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Shereen. Thank you.
So what was going through your mind as you watched the events of this week unfold?
Well, great uncertainty, like most Americans, also with the hope that it would end sometime soon. So as you mentioned already, you know, just over 3 weeks ago, the former Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, was removed. And now we have a new speaker, Mike Johnson. And I think we're heading into new territory here, particularly in terms of Mike Johnson, putting aside for the moment, again, sort of all of the chaos over the last 3.5 weeks or so. For Representative Johnson, now Speaker Johnson, he comes to the speakership not with a lot of leadership, political leadership experience. So he's always been sort of someone sort of in the background producing, once again, papers, filing lawsuits and that sort. So very little is known about him, or if he has, once again, a particular leadership style and how he will actually perform. So there's still a great deal of unknown here, I should say.
Given all of that, when Johnson finally emerged from, let's face it, it was a scrum, how did you view that landing point? Were you surprised that this is what happened?
I wasn't surprised for two reasons. One, in terms of modern American politics, particularly in the House, and in particular, in terms of the Republican Party, the party cohesion is breaking apart. Greater, once again, polarization and fragmentation within parties. So, you know, that was difficult. In terms of for Mike Johnson, he actually sort of, you know, having gone through the first few rounds of, once again, Steve Scalise and Jim Jordan, you know, it sort of became clear that they would need someone that, of course, Democrats would not vote for this person, but someone that all Republicans could sort of get behind. I think Mike Johnson, he fit the bill because, one, he was low profile. He did not have a lot of, once again, other Republicans who maybe really hated him. Maybe they didn't like him, but they didn't hate him. Second, as you pointed out earlier, he's a MAGA supporter. So he, again, and he supported former President Trump. So he got that stamp of approval. And third, I think for the Republican, for the Republicans in the House, they were just exhausted. It was time to move on. Mm-hmm. They were exhausted, and plus they understood that that the United States and the world needs a functioning Congress.
Do you feel like Johnson's lower profile perhaps worked in his favor, given that Representative Jim Jordan has a regular presence on Fox News and he failed?
Yeah, I've heard some commenters make the remark that for Mike Johnson, he's just Jim Jordan in a better suit. So in terms of political ideology, I don't think that they are, in terms of comparing Johnson to Jordan, I don't think they're very far apart. I think where there is a difference in terms of Mike Johnson, the new Speaker of the House, is that one, he's a lawyer. He's a trained lawyer. Strong social conservative, similar to Jordan. And also, again, his, as you mentioned already, his background, he's been more sort of a person, again, not out front. Again, where Jim Jordan was always sort of leading with his chin, if you were. For Mike Johnson, he was always somewhat in the background, but always involved. When you look at his record, you can see that this is someone who has always been, again, part of not just the Republican Party, but a strong social conservative wing of the Republican Party.
We're talking about the new Speaker of the House of Representatives, who took the gavel this week after a contentious few weeks in Washington. Maurice Shepherd is a professor of political science at Madison College, sharing his perspective. You can call in with yours, 800-642-1234. What more should we know about who Mike Johnson is?
Well, I think it's important to know his, as much as we can, his record and who he is. There was an article, I think just yesterday in Politico, that sort of highlights the fact that he has a long paper trail, articles that he has written, interviews he has given, lawsuits that he has been a part of, such as the one, I think it was Texas versus Pennsylvania, that sought to, again, sort of overturn as a election denier of the 2020 presidential election, sought to overturn, once again, that election. We need to know sort of how he thinks. And now his paper trail, the paper record, people are going to start taking a closer look at that. It's not enough to just say that this individual is a social conservative, someone who is clearly, and he has stated on the record clearly, against, once again, reproductive rights, issues related to gender identity. It's important to see exactly, you know, how he thinks and what this might mean for legislation moving into the future. Being the Speaker of the House, he will be able to set that agenda in terms of what legislation comes to the floor and what doesn't.
He hinted at his Christian faith and philosophy on Christianity's central role in American government when he was making his first remarks to the House. Here's a clip.
It was in 1962 that our national motto In God We Trust, was adorned above this rostrum. And if you look at the little guide that they give tourists and constituents who come and visit the house, if you turn in there to about page 14 in the middle of that guide, it tells you the history of this. And it says very simply, these words were placed here above us. This motto was placed here as a rebuke of the Cold War era philosophy of the Soviet Union. That philosophy was Marxism and communism, which begins with the premise that there is no God. This is a critical distinction that is also articulated in our nation's birth certificate. We know the language well, the famous second paragraph that we used to have children memorize in school, and they don't do that so often anymore, but they should.
He went on then to recite that all men are created equal, emphasizing that men are created, not born equal. What do you make of that?
Again, he is, now that he is having greater exposure, we're getting to see more in terms of who and what he really is. I would say, for myself and maybe for others, we need to give him a chance to, you know, sort of get into the position, to understand what his role is. I think, again, and he is a trained constitutional lawyer, so this is not someone who doesn't understand what he's saying. He fully understands what he's saying. But if you're going to be, again, an elected official, in particular, the Speaker of the House, there needs to be some balance there. We have the freedom to, and I am not a once again, a theologian, but, you know, we have the right to, once again, our religious beliefs and that sort. But when it comes to government, I think particularly for the American founders, they looked at government in a much more pragmatic way in terms of American pragmatism. Work, government should be there to serve the people, and religious beliefs and that sort, you know, that's a private matter.
We have Chris on the line from Fairchild who wants to weigh in here. Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Hi. So first off, I would like to just point out that Representative Johnson was one of the key writers of the amicus brief, which was used in many cases to push forth the agenda of disqualifying many electors in the United States, which I happen to disagree with. Also, I would like to point out that any use of language that refers to these people as Republicans, I feel, is inaccurate. I think this really points out a new fractionality within that party and a new form of conservatism, which is not consistent with what we would consider the GOP.
Thanks, Chris, for that call. Maurice, what do you think about what Chris said?
I think Chris is on the mark with that, particularly as it relates to, once again, the idea in terms of the Republican Party. In terms of American political parties, they've never been absolutely, once again, sort of unified on anything. There have always been sort of factions within the Democratic Party and also in the Republican Party. What we see happening right now on the Republican side is, again, a faction there. But again, that faction, in terms of their ideas and their ideology, it's not clear if that will be, how can I put this, put to the best benefit of Americans, that if their ideas are so far sort of to the extreme, they may be inconsistent with most Americans. And I think Chris is also right in terms of, again, identifying those individuals maybe, once again, as Republicans, but of a particular brand. And that's not to say that they are good or bad, but I think at first what we need to do is be able to identify those individuals and understand, again, their position. But they also need to, such as, again, the new speaker, Mike Johnson, articulate how his views, how his ideas will translate into policy. Because at the end of the day, that is what this is about. These individuals are elected by the people, and once again, working for the people. We have a liberal democracy, and that's what they're there for, is to work for the people to protect our rights and our liberties.
We're talking about the new Republican Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson. Our guest is Maurice Shepherd, professor of political science at Madison College. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What should Speaker Johnson be prioritizing? What do you want to see from him as leader of the House? As a voter, how does this election influence how you're thinking about casting your ballot in 2024? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or email us at ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Maurice Shepherd, professor of political science at Madison College, talking about the new Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson of Louisiana, and what he faces right out of the gate in that position. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Maurice, I want to circle back to something that Chris said. He talked about the deep fractionality of the GOP right now. Does it feel like today's version of the GOP is more fractured than in the past?
Yes, across the board in terms of American politics. We talk a lot about political polarization. That polarization occurs between the two dominant parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. But what we're also seeing now is greater polarization within the parties. So even in terms of on the left for the Democratic Party, you know, they have their extremes to the left. In the Republican Party, they have their extremes, once again, sort of to the right. And the challenge here is this: in political science, we talk about having responsible political parties, parties that are, one, unified and that can put together a coherent legislative agenda, but then two, can take that legislative agenda and implement it, and once again, and get that work done. I think what we see in the Republican Party, and also again to the in the Democratic Party to some extent, that this there's no such thing as a responsible party at this point in American politics, that the fractions and the polarization that's taking place between the parties and within the parties, it is to some degree short-circuiting the work of government.
Let's hear what Dennis has to say. Now, Dennis is calling from Two Rivers. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for the call.
Hi. I've heard of Glenn Grossman from the 6th District praise Mike Johnson for being a dedicated Christian, which irks me because, as far as I know, since Mike Johnson is supposedly this great constitutional lawyer, he and Glenn Grossman and others should know we're supposed to have separation of church and state. This is not a case of saying, well, hey, it's my church and my state separated from yours.
What do you think about what Dennis said about the separation between church and state, and why is the Christian nature of some of these representatives important to people?
As a political scientist, I agree with Dennis wholeheartedly. We have enough on our plate, quite frankly, in terms of church and state, on the state side of this, that needs to be addressed. And the two things I'll just highlight, there's a long list of things that Republicans would want. For example, in terms of the Biden impeachment to go forward, again, increasing border security. But the two that really stand out right now for, once again, the new Speaker of the House, the budget. We're headed, once again, we passed a continuing resolution to push the budget issue out until November 17th. That is coming up in a few weeks. That is what I think the new Speaker, quite frankly, needs to focus on. That will have ramifications for Wisconsinites if we again, go without a budget and the government, quote unquote, shuts down. And even if there's a partial shutdown, that will impact, once again, Wisconsinites in terms of federal offices will be closed. Some installations like Fort McCoy, again, will be impacted. So that has real world ramifications. And the second thing is for, once again, the new speaker needs to focus on the upcoming 2024 election cycle. Right now, the Republicans have a razor-thin majority in Congress, and from all the forecasts that I've looked at right now, 2024 is going to be a very tight race. It's going to be a squeaker, and there are two districts here in Wisconsin, the 1st Congressional District and the 3rd Congressional District, in which the forecasts are those particular two districts, they may be in play.
Let's talk with Nate in Milwaukee. Hi, Nate. Thanks for calling. I understand you have some concerns about the Ukraine funding.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. Right now, we have a major war going on of Russian aggression, and it was concerning to me that some Republicans in the House were essentially playing around with the funding to help Ukraine even before they had to stop and find themselves a new speaker for the House. And so that is something I can't see as anything but kind of reckless. And I'm also, I want to give him a chance to show himself, but it is extremely concerning to me that he was involved, as other people have already mentioned, in the effort to basically deny the proper results of the 2020 election. And also, Louisiana itself doesn't exactly have the best reputation when it comes to either corruption or gerrymandering. So there is some reason to be a little bit cautious there, even though I want to give him a chance to basically say, show what he can do. And I don't praise or criticize him for Christianity, but the Ted Cruz is supposed to be a Christian, and he bears false witness. He was involved in the election anti-election efforts in 2020 and a whole bunch of other stuff, which were largely negative.
Thank you, Nate. I appreciate you weighing in on that. And, you know, the election stuff, that's one thing. And then the Ukraine thing. Maurice, what about the Ukraine funding? What's going to happen here?
These are, in terms of support for Israel, in terms of funding, and also for Ukraine, these are complex issues. And this is where there is an ideological difference in terms of there are some individuals, I would say, that see the state and see the United States in we call it sort of as a positive state, that it needs to be active. Also, the idea that the United States has a responsibility to support free democracies around the world. In terms of funding for Israel, they're in an emergency situation right now. Most individuals, particularly in government, believe that funding is critical and necessary. The issue with Ukraine, there is a policy argument here. I think that for some individuals, they simply haven't made that argument clear. They want to support Ukraine, but there needs to be a strategy moving forward. I think for some, we may not want to have sort of funding for Ukraine become sort of an endless war or an endless conflict that we once again support. So there is an argument to be made in terms of funding for Ukraine, in terms of, again, what are the goals of, once again, the Ukrainian, what the Ukrainian people want to achieve, is it achievable and that sort. But to just sort of, as some individuals have done, sort of blanketly say, oh, we just won't fund Ukraine or cut off the funding, that is un-American, to say the least.
In our last 30 seconds, what will you be watching for in terms of his effectiveness as speaker in the coming weeks and months?
To see if he can develop a leadership style. If he is a leader, not everyone's a leader. Again, he has risen to pretty high ranks within the Republican Party based on, once again, his skill as a lawyer and supporting, again, the former president. Now, we have to see if he truly can lead. He will lean a lot on the current Republican leadership, Steve Scalise and others, Stefanik, the Republican conference chair. But at some point, he's going to have to take the reins and he's going to have to sort of lead the way.
Thank you so much, Maurice. We could have talked for another hour, I think.
Yes. Thank you.
Maurice Shepherd is a professor of political science at Madison College. We talked with him today about the chaotic road to Republicans electing Mike Johnson as Speaker of the House of Representatives this week and the work he has ahead of him. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the FCC could bring back net neutrality rules. We'll find out what's changed since the rules were repealed and what a new change could mean for you, and a look at red flag laws in the wake of a deadly shooting in Maine. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we talk about the scariest movies of all time, just in time for Halloween. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.